It is my privilege to introduce to you Dr. William F. Tanna, Regents Professor of Geology, Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida. Dr. Tanna is a graduate in geology of Baylor University, Texas Tech, with his MA and his PhD from Oklahoma University. He is editor of the journal Coastal Research and has performed in that role since 1961, editor of a 6-volume study of coastal sedimentology, author of many technical papers, consultant to many imposing named companies and universities. But Dr. Tanna, if I tell this audience that you taught Dale Moody geology at Baylor University, they'll know who you are by that introduction. Dr. Tanna is a Baptist layman whom it has been my privilege to know. I participated in revival services, as he reminded me, in his church in Tallahassee some years ago and came to know him there. He is an active churchman, a professor of a great university, a scientist, a geologist, and a servant of God, and our friend. Dr. Tanna, we welcome you as the Norton Lecturer for this week.
Thank you, Dr. McCall. Let me express to you first my appreciation for having the privilege of being with you and of sharing some thoughts with you. And particularly, let me share with you the fact that as a faculty member at a tax-supported institution, I am not allowed to say some of the things that I wish to say today. The earth on which we live was created last Friday night. Last Friday night at midnight, to be precise. God waved his wand a single time and did it all instantly. All of the plants and all of the animals were made simultaneously. All of the books, the phonograph records, the magnetic tapes, the photo albums, the diaries, the newspapers, old letters, even memories. Nothing really existed before last Friday night. Do you believe that hypothesis? Scientifically, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference whether you believe it or not. You cannot prove that it is wrong. God, in his ability to foresee and to counter every human approach to the problem, built into his creation whatever is necessary to make you believe that the earth is much older than it really is. You only think that you have been here all of your life because you were created that way. You only think that your parents and your grandparents told you about the good old days because you were created with built-in memories. It is obvious that this hypothesis is correct because God is an all-powerful God and he can do anything we want him to do. In fact, he created the world last Friday night, midnight. Let me identify this hypothesis as the magic wand idea. God waved the magic wand a single time and made it all instantly, and then he rested. Many people, including many Christians, accept the magic wand hypothesis. The only quibble that they raise is that the moment of creation must have created memories and books and carvings and scrolls and monuments because we know that man made these, and that lets God out. So they shove the date of magic wand creation back to some earlier time, but not too much earlier. Perhaps 6,000 years ago would do nicely, including a month. Would you like October? And the day of the week, why not Friday or Saturday? Or I can split the difference and make it Friday night. As anthropologists and archaeologists learn more and more about early man, we either push this date back grudgingly, maybe 8,000 years would be better, or we attack the character of the scientists who are doing the work. But the important thing is to have a magic wand creation as close to the present as possible, but nevertheless maintaining a rigid wall between the important things which man has done, such as making history, and the lesser things that God did previously, like making the universe. If we're going to adopt the magic wand model, we really should make it last Friday night and be completely honest about who did the important work. However, if you don't like the magic wand hypothesis, that's all you can say against it, you don't like it. There are other possibilities, and I'd like to name some of these. Number two is the medieval craftsman. In this theory, God made each item one at a time, but each was made more or less independently of the others, much like in the toy shop that Santa Claus is supposed to have at the North Pole. We may streamline this idea a bit by assuming that he made, for example, all the horses at one time. This allows us to have mass production. And all of the oak trees at some other time, or if you don't like that, you might have him make two horses initially and then turn that part of the business over to them. But even if you made only two horses and two cows and two chickens and two sharks, there are millions and millions of plant and animal species. And the medieval craftsman idea requires that God was a very busy creator. If we examine this hypothesis just a little more, I think it becomes clear that it really doesn't differ from the magic wand idea. In fact, the magic wand idea is better because it isn't cluttered with a whole lot of silly detail that we don't understand very well. After all, there are only 518,400 seconds in 6 days, including the nights, and 172,800 seconds in 6 working days of 8 hours each. And to make 10 million species or more in that interval requires that scores be created every second. It's not necessary to doubt God's ability to make 40 or 60 or 80 species each second. But if we're going to do it this way, we may as well do it last Friday night. Number three is the great puppet master model. With this hypothesis, God made the stage and he made all of the puppets and all of the props, and he now pulls the strings to keep the show moving. This differs from the magic wand hypothesis primarily in a recognition that God may have had something to do with history, and it relegates the beginning to a less important role. But if we look at it more closely, we really see that it achieves only two things. First, we may as well admit that God created the world last Friday night, and second, he has been running it ever since, which is a good thing because we can blame him when something goes wrong. Number four is the creative designer model. In this version, God established the rules, both physical and non-physical, and he made the raw material and the associated energy all in conformity with his master plan. By raw material, I will choose to select the level at which I define that. Perhaps we might say the elements, such as oxygen or hydrogen or carbon or iron or gold. But we might be a little more sophisticated and we might choose to say electrons or protons or neutrons or things of that nature. In this hypothesis, the emphasis is on the design. Here, the expression to create means that God drew the plans and made the energy and the materials and set the entire scheme in motion, following rules which he had established as he worked out the details of the design. That is, he let the mechanism operate and develop. Now here we finally have a version that's different from last Friday night. It has had a history. It differs from the medieval craftsman, and it differs from the great puppet master in the sky. Therefore, we might say that we have two groups of hypotheses. Last Friday night, that includes the others, and the creative designer. The second of these, the creative designer, is a group, because we can develop several different versions of it. For example, we might choose to believe, as some people do, that once God had set the machinery in motion, he walked away from it and just let it run any way it wanted to run. Plenty of people believe that. Or we might choose to believe that once the machinery was functioning properly, according to his design, he turned his attention to non-mechanical matters. Those things that have to do with that spiritual entity that we call the human soul. Which group of hypotheses do you prefer? Last Friday night or the creative designer? I have a very clear choice, but I'm not able to prove that either one of them is wrong. The orderly, systematic, rational, and coherent account in the first chapter of Genesis leads me to prefer the great designer model, which is, as far as I know, the ultimate in orderly design, systematic design, rational design, consistent design. In this hypothesis, we recognize some small part of the exalted position of God, which I see as being well above the medieval craftsman, well beyond the great puppet master in the sky, far from the capricious deity who made the earth last Friday night. Do you prefer the magic wand? My conception of God certainly includes an ability to wave a magic wand, but as I consider his handiwork, I believe I get a little bit closer to his nature when I admire his design capability than when I admire his skill in carving puppets. I'd now like to look at some of the things which I think I see in this world which may have a bearing on the contrast between these two groups of hypotheses. Jesus said that the rain falls on the just and the unjust. That's in Matthew 5:45. A necessary corollary of this is that a drought affects the just and the unjust. We can broaden this statement to say that the presence and the absence of rainfall is noted regardless of the religious affiliations, religious activities, and religious achievements of the people who are affected. This must mean that the rain falls or fails to fall equally on those who pray and those who do not pray. This must even apply to people who are praying for rain, regardless of the fervor or length of their prayers. It's quite a chain of logic, isn't it? But I think it's all there. There must be an opposite side to this remarkable bit of insight. If you go back and read that statement, that's not even the whole 45th verse. It's buried in some other material that Jesus was presenting in the context, I think, is very meaningful. If the rain falls on the just and the unjust, if the rain falls on the praying and the non-praying, if the drought affects Christians and non-Christians, all alike, then there must be some other method of systematizing what we observe when we see rainfall. We've been told quite clearly that we cannot correlate precipitation with righteousness, justice, sincerity, prayer, depth, Christianity, or any of the items that will go on a list that would help you to identify a person you could call just. If none of these factors control rainfall, then we might turn to an observation of physical processes in the atmosphere. In this case, we find a one-to-one correlation. Now, don't tell me at this point that we can't predict the weather, and therefore we don't know anything about it. The atmosphere is a very complicated machine. It has an energy source, the sun, and a rigorous set of rules by which it operates. Our difficulty in the weather stems, in predicting the weather, stems from the fact that the system is so fantastically complicated that we can't even study it very well. But we can study the components in great detail, and we can duplicate the components successfully in the laboratory. The uncertainties that prevent highly precise weather forecasts must not be extrapolated to the idea that rainfall is not mechanistic. It is mechanistic. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. It's a perfectly good statement, and quite intelligible to anybody who cares to read it. It could be reworded as a college professor, and perhaps some of you who are seminary professors, and I'm sure some of you who will grow up and be preachers and seminary professors and things like that. We can always reword things, can't we? Let's try this one. Rainfall is the product of the operation of a certain physical chemical system rigorously controlled by specific processes and relationships. Does that sound like anything you ever had to memorize? Does it add any insight? I don't think so. Rain falls on the just and the unjust. From this statement alone, we may draw a doctrine of the mechanistic nature of our universe. This doctrine is not in agreement with the concept of the great puppet master in the sky, who pulls strings here and there to keep his puppets in motion. The rain falls on the just and the unjust. Perhaps this is an exception and it doesn't apply to anything else. However, Jesus also said that falling rocks and mortar in a construction disaster have nothing to do with the religious standings of the victims, Luke chapter 13, verse 4. There is a necessary corollary here also. That is, if you are not injured in a construction disaster, that has nothing to do with your faith or your prayer life. Construction disasters operate according to certain mechanical principles. The most fundamental principle here is something we call the law of gravity. We can write this law in a rigorous algebraic form, and it's very simple, has only a few symbols in it, and it's easy to memorize. There are no known exceptions, none. A simple statement of the law for the benefit of a child might be that if you place a heavy object near a planet and don't provide mechanical support, then it will fall toward that planet. When we fly in an airplane, we combine the law of gravity with some other principles in a very sophisticated and expensive way, so that we appear to be unsupported. And if you sit in a small plane with a plexiglass window in the floor and can look straight down, that can be unnerving. But without the law of gravity, you would not fly at all. We don't violate the law of gravity, not in any way. The system still continues to operate, in a predictable and perfectly regular way, and we pay a tremendous price for our ability to work with it and get certain results. Flying is no exception to the law of gravity. Without it, we would not even be here. Levitation. I know a man who claims to be a levitator. This is the ability to fly as an individual or to lift a physical body without support of any kind, without contact, without expenditure of energy. This has never been demonstrated. If it did happen, it would be a violation of the law of gravity, but we're talking nonsense. Therefore, we build scaffolding of one kind or another, and we use cranes of one kind or another one, big ones or little ones or whatever, so that we can work with the law of gravity in the erection of a building. And all the time that we're making the building, the law of gravity is continuing to operate. If the scaffolding collapses, we immediately have an investigation, don't we, to see what kind of a mistake was made, such as we used inadequate materials or we connected them together in an improper way. Or we overloaded the structure. No government agency ever carries out an investigation to see if somebody forgot to pray. The reason for this is simple. And basically, we understand it very well. God's mechanical system operates according to fixed principles, not in response to prayer or demonstrations of righteousness. The rain falls on the just and the unjust, and faulty scaffolding falls on the just and the unjust. We live in a systematic, orderly, rational, principled world. Therefore, we can reason, not prove. We can reason that it was created in a systematic, orderly, rational, principled way. Paul wrote in the first chapter of Romans that we learn about God by studying the world which he created. If that creation is a thing of whimsy, without rigorous physical principles, then we can learn only that God is wrapped in whimsy. If, on the other hand, the physical creation is very much like an intricate piece of machinery that always works properly, then we learn that God has been very methodical and very systematic in setting it up. It then seems important to me to point out that God must have been ultimately systematic, completely systematic, systematic beyond the ability which you and I have to comprehend. The conclusion for me is that the great puppet master in the sky, the green elf with the magic wand who sits up on a limb in the tree, and other such theories must be ruled out. God created a marvelous, detailed, absolutely reliable mechanism, and he put us in it. His design capability extended from the largest to the smallest and from the briefest to the most durable. The entire system functions in a perfect way, in a consistent way. It never makes mistakes, never. It never makes mistakes. It never goes wrong. Don't tell me you know a time when it went wrong. It never goes wrong. If you tell me that, I'll tell you I know a time when you went wrong. God's system does not go wrong. Even when we have what we call a natural disaster, and the paper will be full of it, this is not a breakdown of the equipment. It is an orderly part of the operation which you and I don't like. The velocity of light in a vacuum has been measured to be 300,000 kilometers per second. Light from the sun takes 8 minutes to reach the earth. 8 minutes. Light from the sun takes approximately 6 hours to reach Pluto, the outermost planet. 6 hours. Since we're neither on the sun nor on Pluto, how can we know that? Well, we know it in several different ways. because we can measure the speed or velocity of magnetic radiation, including light, radio waves, all sorts of things. And we have made many such measurements. They can be made so precisely that we can make them over a very short distance, but we've had a chance to verify them by making measurements, for example, between the Earth and the Moon, when we put equipment on the Moon. We've been making them with very great precision halfway across the solar system with the instrumented packages which we've been sending to the outer planets. And some of you surely have seen some of the pictures that have come back and have been impressed by them. To send the signal to the package and to get the response takes an elapsed time that is measured in the hours. The light from the closest star takes 4 years to reach us. We measure that from the light. Its character is changed in a measurable way. If that star has a habitable planet, I don't think it does, but if it did, and if you could establish radio telephone contact with an individual, a person, a creature on that planet, and if you said, hello, are you there? And if he said, yes, I am here, that would take 8 years. Light crossing the galaxy in which we live, our galaxy, the Milky Way, from the most distant star, we're in part of the backwash of the galaxy here, on one edge. Light from the most distant star all the way across our galaxy to our location takes 120,000 years to get from the other side to our edge. 120,000 years, that's 300,000 kilometers per second, and there's something like 31.7 million seconds in a year. It takes 120,000 years just to get across our galaxy, which is only one sort of nondescript galaxy among millions. As we reach out beyond our galaxy, we find that stars are farther and farther away. The distances are tremendous. Light travels 9.5 quadrillion kilometers in a year. 9.5 quadrillion kilometers really doesn't mean anything to us, does it? Beyond our galaxy, stars have tremendous distances, and from a very distant galaxy, light may take 11 billion years to get here. This is a measurable figure. You don't have to go out there to measure it. 11 billion years to get here. We do not see these objects now. Starlight that arrives at an optical telescope now, or at a radio, or radio signals that arrive at a radio telescope now, give us information about that star or that galaxy, which is only a needle point in the distance, at the time when that signal left the source. That is, starlight that took 1 million years to get to our planet is telling us about that star 1 million years ago. We have no information at all about that star now. Nothing. You may agree with me that we should elect to believe that that star is still out there and that it continues to function, doing whatever it is that stars are supposed to do, but we have no data to support that. Nothing. Just a choice. Therefore, when you look at the stars at night, I hope you look at them. You have a command in the Bible to do it. When you look at the stars at night, you might as well ask the question, I wonder what it all looks like now, because you've never seen it now. What you see now is only the set of images that was created millions or billions of years ago. Each day we continue to receive additional signals from distant stars and distant galaxies, and these are parts of the entire system, but we see them only through a long tube into the distant past. And anything you wish to say about the stars today has to be a matter of faith on your part. If the silverware is stolen, will you deny that a thief took it? Do you believe in a bark unless there's a dog barking? How about sunshine without any sun? or taxes without a government of any kind? Do you believe in results without causes? When you look at the stars at night, what do you see? Light that was created recently for which there are no stars? A giant fraud perpetrated on us in order to make the night sky look beautiful? The Bible tells us to consider God's handiwork. We are to take it at face value. We are to admire it. We are to study it. We are to contemplate it. We are to measure it. We are to think about it. But we cannot consider or contemplate or study or measure handiwork that does not exist. We are to study the stars, not the fictitious starlight that came from nowhere. Do you believe there are real stars behind the starlight? If we accept the observations, then the universe must be billions of years old. 20 is a nice round number. If you don't like that one, I have a few others handy. Or do you believe that it was all created last Friday night? The geologist is accustomed to thinking in terms of very long intervals of time. We have hundreds of thousands of radiometric dates on which to base the geological calendar, approximately 900,000 individual specific radiometric dates. These are measures of time. On that calendar, the solar system was made some 4.5 billion years ago. I hope you understand the way I pronounce that second letter of the alphabet. I'm not saying million, I'm saying billion. 10 to the ninth power, billion. 4.5 billion years ago. This date has been obtained repeatedly from a number of meteorites, and dates very close to that from rocks collected on the moon, where we did send a geologist. If you did not know your taxes went for that, we put a geologist on the moon. All the rest of the people up there were just playing. No rock on the Earth is quite that old, because weathering processes in our atmosphere here on the Earth have destroyed the oldest rocks. But the oldest rocks on the Earth date at just a sliver under 4 billion years old, and each of these has within it evidences of a very long history prior to that. And so we take the meteorite dates and the lunar dates and the history that we see with the very old Earth rocks and conclude that our Earth is 4.5 billion years old. That'd make the universe 5 or so times older than the solar system. And all of this long history reveals the detailed functioning of a complicated machine that never makes mistakes. Never. We don't like that. We don't. And some of you who will agree with me will proceed immediately to think in terms of mistakes of nature. We like to extend mistakes of nature thinking to things that we call disasters, but these are not mistakes in the machinery, they're disasters only in our thinking. We refer to a disaster as an act of God or an intervention of God. This has given many people the quaint idea that if something good happened, we did that part, but if something bad happened, God's responsible for that part. A hurricane is a very natural manifestation of certain meteorological processes. Man perceives a hurricane as a natural disaster, but this is not nature gone crazy. This is not nature gone mad. This is absolutely rigorously controlled activity in the world of meteorology. The machinery continues to function. We've had some bad hurricanes. You know what? We can predict with great assurance that we will have some more bad hurricanes, and people who move into the paths of hurricanes are going to be affected by them. And I might even paraphrase the saying of Jesus and say, a hurricane strikes the just and the unjust. A volcano erupts and pours out tremendous volumes of ash and lava and various gases, which are all poisonous. And people who are caught in the path of this material may very well be killed. Vesuvius destroyed and erupted and destroyed two towns at its foot in AD 79, in 1902, Montpellier and Martinique. erupted and killed 30,000 people. The explosion of Krakatoa near Java in 1883 set up a wave that drowned over 36,000 people. Is it true that volcanoes kill the just and the unjust? These events do not seek out people. Volcanoes were erupting, hurricanes were taking place, and all of the other activities that we do not like were operating just as they do now, long before mankind existed on the planet. And at that time, they were not punishing the wicked. Paul was rescued from a subterranean dungeon by a minor earthquake. The dungeon didn't fall in, it was a minor earthquake. Was this a miracle? Many people like to think that Paul and other people collected miracles like a small boy might collect bottle tops. You know, you just have a bag full of them around all the time. But Greece is a violently seismic country. And seismic activity there has been high for thousands of years. A small earthquake there is a minor event. The jailer was not worried about the earthquake. He'd been through them before. He was worried about his prisoners. In fact, the earthquake that freed Paul from his bonds may very well have done a great deal of damage in some other part of Greece, but the Bible would not record that for us. The earthquake was a natural event in a place where the countryside bounces all the time. If it was a miracle, it was a miracle only because you perceived it as a miracle. Let's do that statement one more time. Earthquakes strike both the just and the unjust. Let me summarize some of this by saying that God, the creative designer, that's my preferred model, established a system which is so complex that its various activities peak from time to time, and we call these peaks disasters because we don't like them. He then placed us within that system. The rain falls on the just and the unjust, and that means that the system is a mechanistic and an impersonal system. The system does not care what happened to you or to me. It couldn't care less. God is not interested fundamentally in getting us to escape from disasters. It's his system. Surely he does not think he made a mistake. Instead, he is very much interested in how we react to disasters. Some people blame God and accuse him of being cruel. Some people complain about God and state that they could design a better system. I have to disagree. They can't even design a worse system. There is no evidence anywhere that anybody has ever designed a system except the one that God designed. And he beat us to that one, didn't he? As far as I can see from the evidence that is at hand, this is the only system. I know a chemist who some years ago announced that he had designed the fundamental items for creating a system that was totally different from the one we have now. He did not succeed. He didn't even get to first base. I have placed this morning God as man as a creature of God in a framework of a vast machine about which we really don't know a great deal. This machine always operates correctly, always. Makes no mistakes. Has no disasters. Scientist tries to learn something about it, but we as Christians should recognize that God works with us, not for us, within the framework of that machinery. Remember, the rain falls on the just and the unjust. It would be a mistake to conclude from this that God is not the creator. I personally reject the hypothesis that we have a mechanistic system that just happened. It would be a mistake to conclude that he has left us to fight a hostile and inexorable machine. In the sense that God made the entire creation, he is behind everything that it does, whether we like the operation or not. It is his world, and he made it right. And he put each of us in a specific part of it for a purpose.
When we are faced with disaster, he does not reroute the disaster, but rather he offers to help us reroute our thinking. He does not zap us from heaven with thunderbolts, a little green elf sitting up in the tree or on the edge of a cloud, nor does he send flying saucers or witches in the night, nor even milk and honey. Do we have a choice in any of this? Of course we do. But the only choice that really matters in the long run is the choice that we make when we get down to the serious business of thinking about God and his creation. Do you believe the earth was created last Friday night? Or do you believe in the great puppet master in the sky who has silver and gold threads with which he controls our movements? Or would you prefer that God has made you as a rational being and has faced you with a system that is so complicated that at times it seems irrational? Yet he has offered to help you tune your thinking so that each disaster and each near disaster can lead you closer to him. Thank you.